WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave in for Terry Gross. As workers continue the agonizing task of clearing and cataloging the rubble at the site where the World Trade Center once stood, a debate has already begun about what should fill the hole left by terrorism. Some have proposed rebuilding the Twin Towers exactly as they were, as an act of defiance and optimism, the sooner the better. Others support establishing a park, a place of beauty and peace, to memorialize the victims and help the city heal. Most agree that the tragedy is an opportunity to reconsider what kind of city New York is in the wake of the attacks, and that whatever rises at the site should reflect the city's new identity. My guest, Anthony Vidler, is acting dean of the Cooper Union School of Architecture in New York City. He's currently on leave as professor of art history and architecture at UCLA and is the author of Warped Space, Art, Architecture, and Anxiety in Modern Culture. I asked him what architectural vision the World Trade Center reflected when it was conceived back in the 1960s.
Well, I think it was the, if you like, the apotheosis of an architecture of business, of an architecture of communication and flow and international global trade and commerce that really began in this country to take flight in the late 1940s and 50s. I would say that the first buildings, if you like, to symbolize this sense of an architecture of business, a business art, as architects used to call it. They were buildings that were built, as C. Wright Mills said it very pertinently, as almost as giant file cabinets for the efficient organization of business. And it seems to me that the World Trade Center, with its massive pileup of floors, its extraordinary, if you like, almost anonymity of the external appearance, was in a sense the largest version of this great office building boom that took off after the war.
Another word that gets kicked around when people talk about this vision of efficiency in business is transparency. This was the
right.
Transparent architecture. What did they mean by that?
Well, in the 1920s and 30s, when architects in Europe and especially began to frame the terms in which modern architecture or modernist architecture might be built, they were extremely excited about the new materials, new industrial materials of iron, glass, steel, glass, concrete, about the possibilities of buildings, in a sense, bringing light into their interiors. And of course, in an office building, one of the most important questions before the major introduction of artificial lighting systems was to bring light into a deep interior so that Secretary Pools and the executives could work in daylight. Secondly, in the 20s and 30s, there was a tremendous utopian enthusiasm for the rebuilding of cities that had been caked in soot and dirt and grime from the Victorian steam age, so to speak, and the notion of these glistening glass towers, which, if they were glass, seemed to dissolve into refracted light. The Pepsi-Cola building or Manufacturers Trust building in New York are very, very powerful visions of that transparency. If you think of the Manufacturers Trust building, which has this great safe, the bank safe, transparently exposed and in the center of it, you have a sense of how these buildings should have were imagined as public buildings, as belonging to the public, as accessible to the public, and as part of a new glistening modern utopia.
You've written that in certain terms, the skyscrapers were meant to dispel people's fears of city life, to dispel their neuroses about the closeness of it, which is really ironic when you think that skyscrapers have ended up being such a focus of fear and anxiety for people.
It's interesting because in my book Warped Space, I talk about the way in which city space, has since the late 19th century been seen by inhabitants of cities as a kind of locus, as a place which, if you like, embodies their various fears, anxieties, what Freud called neuroses, that we've seen that in the opening up and broadening of the boulevards in Paris, many people describe sensations which we now call agoraphobic. And we've seen that in the condensed apartment buildings that became a way of life in the modern cities in the late 19th, 30th, 20th century, people experienced what is now called claustrophobia. Doctors tended in those days to literalize people's anxieties in such a way as ascribing them directly to the places in which they found themselves, to the places in which they felt those anxieties. I think in the 1920s there were some 400 or 500 different phobias, many of which were ascribed to place, to sites, acrophobia, fear of heights on acropolises, and so on and so forth. So yes, indeed, there are many places. I don't know a space in modern society that has not been attributed to the inspiration of one phobia or another.
I'm speaking with Anthony Vidler. He's the acting dean at the Cooper Union School of Architecture. He's also the author of Warp Space, Art, Architecture, and Anxiety in Modern Culture. How do you see the September 11th attack changing or challenging our ideas about the city, given that there's always been this split in the image of New York between people who saw it as pure possibility and a place where miracles happened and it was the biggest and the best and it welcomed everyone? And then, on the other hand, there was the idea that it's a scary, crime-ridden and decadent, arrogant place, our national mammon. Have the attacks changed those polar images of New York?
Not so much about how you design cities in the wake of terrorism, because I think there's no way in which you can design cities in the wake of terrorism. This is a specific kind of attack. It will change its nature over and again. Terrorism doesn't know cities to attack. It knows only sites and specific moments. And so, for me, it's an opportunity to rethink the difficulties and problems that we have had in shaping and framing architectural spaces for living and working in cities of high density since the Second World War. And I think that it would be a shame to repeat the difficulties of the overdevelopment of the 60s, for example, simply because we feel it's a brave and proud act to rebuild exactly as it was before.
You just said that you can't design for security. You can't design against a terrorist attack. I think someone was quoted saying, you can't design for the epicenter of an earthquake.
Exactly.
Is that what you mean? It's not...
In the sense that we design for living. We don't design for dying. We design for community. We don't design for specific moments. My sense is that to design a city of checkpoints, of surveillance, of video cams, of stop and go, of identity cards, would be a city not worth living in. And it would also be a very difficult city to escape from. I think one of the interesting lessons we learned unfortunately and unhappily on September 11th was in fact the permeability and the openness of the number of ways of leaving the site was an aid to the escape of those who fortunately were able to survive the bombing. And so I think that no amount of designing for space being defensible will necessarily defend space. I think it's up to us to defend space by our community activities, by the life we live in it, by the kinds of values we project from it. And the rest, I would say, is up to a very good, equitable foreign policy.
In terms of learning from history, what worked about the site? What worked about the Twin Towers?
Well, as you know, the Twin Towers were very contentious when they were first built. both as objects and as objects of such enormous size.
I think that they were those big, windswept, freezing in the winter and barren in the summer, that they inspired very little human feeling.
In those terms, yes. But also, I think when we're thinking of urban life, we think of a mix of activities, and what I think the density of commercial space in that area has up to quite recently precluded. Was the development of small-scale businesses, of the kinds of businesses that support everyday living activities. Park spaces have only very recently and almost reluctantly been inserted into areas that are needed now for those who live in Battery Park and even around the municipal center. So there are dozens of stories that I've heard from architects and others of those who are bringing up the second wave of children in these areas. And it would be, I think, a great shame to ignore that this has become a vital area of living for New Yorkers and not just an area of commerce.
I'm speaking with Anthony Vidler. He's the acting dean at the Cooper Union School of Architecture. He's a professor of art history and architecture at UCLA, currently on leave from that university. We'll talk more about the various proposals for rebuilding the site of the World Trade Center after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Anthony Vidler. He's acting dean at the Cooper Union School of Architecture. He's also the author of Warped Space, Art, Architecture, and Anxiety in Modern Culture. Were you in New York on September 11th?
I was indeed.
And what did you see of the attack?
I saw every moment of the drama of the World Trade Center from the roof of the Cooper Union, then down on the ground a little closer, and from almost a second or two after the first strike.
Given your background, and I don't assume that this is what would be going through your mind when you're watching such a horrific event, but did you have an engineer's sense of how the buildings would stand the impact of the planes and the fire?
I had an instantaneous sense of a kind of a brilliant, almost architectural, rendered image of the interior of these office floors, of the interior of the escape stairs, of the interior of the elevators, and of what was happening inside. And I can't say that that was anything but I just felt entirely suffocated. I was amazed, actually, to tell you the truth, at how long each of the two buildings stood. I was told by the responsible engineer for the two towers were in fact built to withstand the impact of a 727, not necessarily at that height and not necessarily loaded with so much fuel, but indeed they stood, one of them for nearly an hour, one of them for over an hour, allowing for thousands of those on the floors below the impact to escape. And so in that respect, I would say that the engineering was as good as it could have been in the 60s.
In the wake of the terrorist attacks, are there specific recommendations for safety measures that you think architects will be inserting into their plans?
I would obviously ask for much wider fire stairs that are not based on the calculation of the amount of rentable space you can get if they're smaller and so on and so forth, and much tougher structures. But again, as we understand, nothing can withstand nuclear attack. We can't build buildings, and we didn't build buildings throughout the 50s and 60s during the great time of fear and threat of nuclear annihilation. I don't think we can build buildings for the threat of terrorism. I do think we can reflect on safety in high buildings. One of the interesting facts I've, I uh, uncovered in looking through the history of tall buildings in Manhattan is that after the first, one of the first fatal fires in a skyscraper in Manhattan, a much lower skyscraper, of course, in 1912, a commission reported to the city that perhaps the height of skyscrapers should be calibrated in terms of the time that it takes to evacuate the inhabitants of that building in relationship to its ability to withstand fire.
Now, you're acting dean at the Cooper Union, which is downtown. Now that the towers are no longer there, some people have, in the neighborhood, have talked of losing their bearings. Have you felt that?
It's true that, that architecture very quickly, whether it's vilified or not vilified, becomes a landmark. I remember the tremendous debates over the construction and of the Eiffel Tower, which was in Paris, which was supposed to be a temporary structure. And when it didn't come down, people were outraged. And I always remember the story of the novelist Maupassant, who was asked why, if he hated the tower so much, did he lunch there every morning on the top of the tower? He said, "Well, quite frankly, it's the only place in Paris from which I cannot see the tower." And so it is true that buildings become landmarks, and certainly the World Trade Center. I came to this country before it was built in the early 60s, and I was then teaching in Princeton, and every time I came to New York and saw these towers rising, they became the natural landmark of, you know, the sort of moment of, oh, finally I'm getting to the city and back to street life again. Peter Wheelwright, the chair of architecture at Parsons School, who lives very close to the towers and was evacuated very quickly, spoke the other night of the way in which the towers were the place that he pointed his children to if they got lost. You know, just if you get lost downtown, just make for those towers and you're home. So yes, they become a landmark, but it's quite clear that other landmarks will take their place. It's very interesting how now we see the old skyscrapers almost so much more clearly. We see the Woolworth Building actually as the landmark that it was originally meant to be.
There was a recent New York Times article on this debate about rebuilding the site, and the point was made that the towers were built at a time when New York was aspiring to be a global financial center, that it was staking its claim very loudly and emphatically. But now that position is secure, and I think the quote was, "It need only whisper its intent." It's an interesting call for subtlety in architecture, in remembrance. Do you have an idea of a vision of that?
In a way, I would rephrase that first statement, and I was saying, yes, they were built at a time when high buildings represented that aspiration. In other words, the notion of building taller and taller and taller and taller. Remember Frank Lloyd Wright at one point in his career coming out and demanding a mile-high skyscraper for Chicago. There's a sense that this has always been a kind of almost aesthetic aspiration to symbolize power. I think that if we look at some of the other proposals of the 60s for occupying the World Trade Center site with the World Trade Center, there's a very elegant proposal by Skidmore, Owings & Merrill, which is a very relatively low, flat, you know, pancake building with courtyards in it, and a very small scale slab, rather like that of the United Nations building beside it. I would think that it's possible for institutions to have power without necessarily symbolizing that power through height. Maybe it's time for institutions, especially public institutions, to demonstrate a kind of openness to access as opposed to a parade of symbolic monumentality.
Do you have different ideas about what architecture means to us or the strength of our attachment to buildings as symbols after experiencing the terrorist attacks?
Well, I think what is very, very clear and has been clear is that whatever the architects of buildings and spaces intend originally, whatever the clients of those buildings and spaces intend for the architect to symbolize initially, is radically transformed by use, radically transformed by time and history. And symbolic associations shift as our understanding of the importance and nature of institution shifts. So what can be symbolic of a great aspiration one day becomes symbolic of an evil intention the next, for example. We saw that in the monumental pomp of National Socialism, for example, in Germany in the 30s and 40s. I have no single answer about what kind of architecture makes a particular kind of symbolic effect or resonance on a population. It changes as populations, aspirations, and natures themselves change. So my sense is that you never can tell.
Anthony Vidler, thank you very much for talking with me today on Fresh Air.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
Anthony Vidler is acting dean of the Cooper Union School of Architecture. I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is Fresh Air.